Good morning, everybody. When Scott said what my talk was this morning, the first time, I'm like, uh-oh. All right. Before we begin, I just wanted to do a quick plug for my friends Brian and Audrey. They run a website called Remnant Online Fellowship. You can go to our book table, pick up a card, and Brian and Audrey, through their website, connect you to other Bible conferences, prophecy conferences, worldview conferences, other ministries, like-minded organizations, and individuals. So pick up one of these. Right on. Absolutely. Alrighty. We're going to hit a pretty hard topic this morning. I'm sure that you're ready for your brain to be stimulated a little bit. So we're going to be talking about spiritual politics and the cult of world order. It really is a discussion of how politics and religion come together. And I think you're going to see that as we go through this presentation, that you're going to be able to start piecing things together in terms of how religions are all working and looking to gel themselves around a political ideology. So why do a presentation like this? I liked reminding my audience, even though they may have heard, you know, the same talk last night, on some certain key areas. Remind you so that you have it in your mind. Why do a study like this? First of all, so that you're not uninformed as to the direction of our society. I want you to see past the media hype, past the clickbait, past all of that, so that you can grasp what is going on, seeing past the rumors and the sensational. Sometimes it's important to do a talk like this so you can connect the dots in your own life. I've always been amazed, and I shouldn't be amazed because this is real life, how often I've had people come up to me and say, look, what you've just described, we're experiencing this in our church or our denomination, or we have a first-hand story to tell you about this. Also, to be warned so that we don't become gullible participants, because we are. We are. The stuff we're talking about today, in many respects, points back to the Christian community, and you will see that. And then to see how the Christian message is being challenged. I want you to see past the surface, right to the core, right to the heartbeat of where the Christian message is being challenged in our global world. And in all of this, I'm hoping that you're also equipped so that you can see how the culture is preaching to you, and that you also can be strengthened in your faith, recognizing the times we live in. But if all of this is just simply to excite you, to tickle your ears, that would be the wrong motive. I'm really hoping that with all of this in mind, you become effective ambassadors for Christ. Because if you heard my talk last night, you know that you are the legal and official representative of your King. And again, as I said last night, there is no higher calling that I can think of. And this is to equip you in that task. Not that we are antagonistic, but rather we are ambassadors in truth and ambassadors in love. And that's very important. All right, and the one other aspect of this, and this talk today is a lot about this aspect of why we need to wrap our heads around this. Context, context, context. I want you to see that there is a continuity of a big idea that stretches through generations, and that we are seeing it in its fruition, in its culmination, and that this is a part of the larger story of our human experience. I don't go into it. I do in the book. But if you want to see where this really begins, you go back to the Tower of Babel. You go back to the Tower of Babel where we declare that man is in charge. We are in charge of our meaning and destiny. And we shut God out and we build our own order. If you want to see the first world order, you look to the Tower of Babel. Incidentally, that's not the first city mentioned in the Bible. The first city mentioned in the Bible is the city of Enoch, found in Genesis chapter 4. What's interesting there is that also is an example of building world order, personal order. Cain, if you know the story, Cain has just killed his brother Abel. God has chastened him, and there's a consequence, and that is to wander. Cain says, I can't do that. That's too heavy. That's too heavy. God says, I will be the one who protects you, gives him a mark. Cain leaves. He wanders. And then he settles and builds a city. And it's called Enoch. And in doing so, that is symbolic of my power and my security comes through the works of my hands. When we are faced with a curse or when we are faced with consequences, we don't turn to God and say, help. We say, I will build it myself. I will fix my own problem. And what we're looking at today is all about that. We will do this. We will fix our own problem. We save ourselves. So as I mentioned last night, there are two primary ways that you can look at reality. My friend Dr. Peter Jones, in his book, The Other Worldview, puts it this way. If God and nature make up reality, then all is two, and everything is either creator or creature. On the other hand, if the universe is all there is, then all is one. And this is so important. So important. I mean, this is as fundamental as it gets, as basic as it gets. But boy, oh boy, we need to get back to the basics. We need to recognize that the biblical worldview is God separate from nature. God is outside of nature. He is bigger than nature. He is the creator. He is not creation. That's twoism, not dualism, twoism. Or you could look at it as otherness. Whereas this other view, the dominant worldview, is man, God, and nature are all essentially the same. And how you view those two worldviews or those two paradigms will dictate how you look at politics, religion, gender, culture, technology, the list goes on and on. So quickly, I want to reinforce that aspect of otherness. And Genesis chapter 1 brings that out right away. God is a categorical and distinct judge of creation. And he puts creation in order. He first of all creates in Genesis 1, yet he remains apart from it. He is different from it. He divides light and darkness. He divides land and sea. He divides species. He has distinctions. He doesn't so much divide species. He has distinctions within species. There is a distinction between us and the animal world. We are different because we are created in his image. We are different. We are his representatives. And there's even distinctions in gender. Very, very clear distinctions. It's interesting. The animal world isn't confused by this. It takes humanity to be confused by this, doesn't it? Right. I know. The God we serve, it does divide. He does divide. There is value and there is judgment. Turn in your Bibles to Isaiah chapter 45. I want to remind you who this God is that we serve. We're looking at Isaiah chapter 45, and then after that we'll flip pretty quick into John chapter 1. Consider these words. Truly, you are God, who hide yourself, O God of Israel, the Savior. They shall be ashamed and also disgraced, all of them. They shall go in confusion together, who are makers of idols. But Israel shall be saved by the Lord with an everlasting salvation. You shall not be ashamed or disgraced forever and ever. For thus says the Lord, who created the heavens, who is God, who formed the earth and made it, who has established it, who did not create it in vain, who formed it to be inhabited, I am the Lord and there is no other. I have not spoken in secret, in a dark place of the earth. I did not say to the seed of Jacob, seek me in vain. I, the Lord, speak righteousness. I declare things that are right. Assemble yourselves and come. Draw near together, you who have escaped from the nations. They have no knowledge, who carry the wood of their carved image and pray to a God that cannot save. Tell and bring forth your case. Yes, let them take counsel together. Who has declared this from ancient time? Who has told it from that time? Have not I, the Lord? And there is no other God besides me. A just God and a Savior, there is none besides me. Look to me and be saved, all you ends of the earth, for I am God and there is no other. Pretty categorical. Pretty categorical. Let's break this quickly down. There's first of all the acknowledgement of God's salvation. wrapped up in this passage. Those who trust in idols, they will be ashamed. There will be shame on them. Israel's salvation is everlasting. Why? This is important. Because God is the creator of all things. He's different than creation. He made this. You can trust in His eternal salvation because He is the one that created all things. It's not the nation state. It's not some organization. It's not some committee. It's not some bureaucracy somewhere. God did it. And He is trustworthy because of that. God can be known. Verse 19 brings that out. God can be known. He didn't do this in secret. He can be sought. False gods can't save. There's no knowledge in them. Verse 21 is really, I like 21. Basically, it's throwing this in their face. Hey, do you think your false gods and your idols can save? Really? Really? Then bring forth your case. Bring it on. Bring your case forward. Compare. Compare. No, they don't save. They don't compare against the true God. Therefore, look to God. Look to Him, because He alone saves. There is no other. Turn now quickly to John chapter 1. And we see God in flesh. God in flesh. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through Him, and without Him nothing was made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. There was a man sent from God, whose name was John. This man came for a witness, to bear witness of the light, that all through him might believe. He was not that light, but was sent to bear witness of that light. That was the true light, which gives light to every man coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made known, pardon me, was made through him, and the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own did not receive him. But as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, to those who believe in his name, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we beheld His glory, and the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness of Him and cried out, saying, This was He of whom I said, He who comes after me is preferred before me, for He was before me. And of His fullness we have all received, and grace for grace. For the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, who is in the bosom of the Father, He has declared Him. This is Christ and Christ alone. We see this passage broken down this way. In the beginning, as God, all things were created through Him. The Word was in the beginning. He is the author of life and life eternal. And I'm going to quickly just go on a rabbit trail. This is really important, recognizing that He is the author of life. When I was a younger person, I struggled with why death? Why death? Of all the consequences for our sin found in Genesis, why death? Why something so final, so catastrophic, so tragic? Why death? Listen, if God is the author of life, if God is the author of life, death is the logical outcome when we turn our back to the author of life and walk away. That wasn't God's doing. That's our doing. That's our judgment on us. And it makes logical sense. If you turn your back on the author of life, death is the logical outcome. This is so important. This is also important because of the resurrection. If He's the author of life, He defeats death. And in Him, then, there is hope. Anyways, on to verse 5, He is the light that shines in the darkness. Jesus Christ is that light. John was witness to that light. And on we go. Jesus Christ is the Redeemer of Israel, but Israel didn't receive Him. Those who receive Him are the children of God, both Jew and Gentiles. The Word, Jesus Christ, becomes flesh. And in all this, John is telling you, remember, I was a witness to this. I was a witness to this. It's my eyewitness account. And then grace is before us. God's grace. God's grace and truth comes through Jesus Christ, God made flesh. You know, the God that we serve is exclusive. Pardon me, he's inclusive in that he wants all to come to him, but he is exclusive in that it is through his Son, Jesus Christ. Important to keep in mind, especially as we go through the interfaith side of this presentation. So Jesus says in John 14, 6 and 7, you know this passage, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you had known me, you would have known my Father also. And from now on, you know him and have seen him. It is the exclusive message of Jesus Christ. I want to quickly switch gears. If oneness is the dominant worldview, and it is, you will see this come through in a variety of different ways, from technology to education to our ethics, our morality. And this morning I want to demonstrate it's also through religion and to a degree also in politics. I'm going to take you on a journey into interfaithism and a journey into global governance. And I want you to see that the two of them end up mixing to some degree. I do a talk just on global governance, on world order, but here what I'm doing is I'm combining some elements from two chapters in my book. And along the way, I'm literally going to take you on two road trips with me and allow you to see how interfaithism lives itself out. The very first interfaith parliament took place in 1893 in Chicago. It was the Parliament of World Religions. 8,000 religious leaders, interested personalities, social changers came to Chicago in 1893 to celebrate a new dawn, to celebrate a new age. It was a turning point, and it really is a turning point in Western religious thinking, as now the West embraces the East and embraces occultism and esotericism and all kinds of weird and different ideas. This was a melting pot. A statement came out of the 1893 Parliament that I think sums it up beautifully. The religion of the future will be universal in every sense. It will embody all the thoughts and aspirations and virtues and emotions of all humanity. It will draw together all lands and peoples and kindreds and tongues into a universal brotherhood of love and service. It will establish upon earth a heavenly order. We are building heaven on earth. We are building heaven on earth, and we do it by coming together, all faiths, as we construct our new order. The idea of religions involved in order, world order, isn't a new idea. In fact, during World War I, there was a lot of pressure on the Christian community that, look, if we want to secure world peace and world order, it's imperative that the Christian community, Christian brethren, we come together and we all work for oneness, and we all work for a new harmony. And so here's a couple of statements, both by social justice preachers during the time of World War I and immediately after, as they looked forward to the idea of a Christian world order, a religious world order, not a biblical world order, but we're constructing this on our own. Keep in mind, again, this was aimed at the Christian community, us. We're going to build the new heaven on earth. Frederick Lynch said this way. He said, what we need here is a form or a compact or a league of nations or some sort of United Nations of the world. That's from his book, The Challenge, the Church, and the New World Order, 1916. Samuel Batten, a minister, put it this way in his book, The New World Order, from 1919. If there is to be a new world, it must come first of all through a new spirit in the nations. There must be created an international mind and consciousness. Men must learn to think of humanity as one family and to have a world patriotism. They must keep their minds free from jealousy and selfishness and base their policy and practice upon true and Christian principles. They must be quick to resent injustice by a nation as by any individual. Humanity must become an ideal in order that it may become an actuality. World patriotism must be a faith, a chivalry, before it can be an organization. International peace must become an aspiration, a religion, before it will become a reality. There must be some international organization which shall make the new ideas effective and secure world justice. I break down what the Christian community was saying during World War I in my book, and it's surprising how at that point the Christian community was saying, we're going to build a righteous world order, and we're going to be the ones who secure heaven on earth. Something very similar was happening during World War II. In World War II, John Foster Dulles ended up heading a commission with the Federal Council of Churches, and this commission was to secure world order as a Christian duty, a religious duty. And so this is one of the statements that came out of the Federal Council of Churches at the time. The ultimate requirement is a duly constituted world government of delegated powers, an international legislative body, an international court with adequate powers and adequate international police forces, and provisions for worldwide economic sanctions. That's what we were supposed to do. No, thank you. We're not the ones who build heaven on earth. Christ is the one who comes down. And he doesn't require us to build his order first. Don't kid yourself. There are some in the Christian world that think that way, that it's up to us to build heaven on earth, then Christ comes down. No, no, we don't do that. But it was interesting. That was a thought during World War II in a significant way. The Methodists had a crusade for world order. The Northern Baptist Convention held world order crusades. There were letter writing campaigns. Hundreds of letters flowed in to Washington, D.C. saying, we need a world order. In fact, the 1946 Southern Baptist Convention had a statement in there from one of their annual meeting special committee reports. We believe that the goal of peacemakers must be a world organized on the Christian principles of order and justice. We further believe in the field of international relations, such a goal can be accomplished only by some sort of world government. Accordingly, we recommend that Southern Baptists endorse the principle of world federation and work towards amending and improving the world, improving the United Nations organization to achieve that end. We might be going, what? What? Listen, I know we have some folks in the room who are around during World War II, but you were already younger. You were already probably maybe in, what, your teens, for those of you who are in that bracket. But World War II had a very concerted public movement that maybe your parents or your pastors or your community leaders were involved with. And that was the idea of pressuring and pushing for world order, primarily through world federalism. And churches were on board. Here is from 1952, a brochure that was sent out to churches all across the U.S., hoping that April 27th, that's this weekend, right? April 27th, 1952 would be World Government Sunday. And in approximately 500 church leaders in Southern California were specifically asked to deliver sermons and literature on world federalism. But it was a nationwide campaign. And so I have the document at home in my archives. It even gives you texts for sermon ideas, what passages you should use, some of the resources you could use, suggestive thoughts that you as pastors could use in helping your church become good global citizens and work for world order and world government. We were doing it. Crazy stuff. I've got it well documented. We have historical amnesia. I'm hoping this kind of just wakes us up a bit, okay? We were part of the problem. I want to flip forward because this also has a contemporary context. So I want to take you with me on a little road trip. I'm actually going to take you on three little road trips on this in this presentation. The first is to Winnipeg. Yay! Yay. Oh, well. Yes. What's interesting is Winnipeg hosted the G8 World Religion Summit in 2010. Now, most folks know that when we have the G8 political summits, The spotlight, of course, is on what happens at those summits. Now, that year, the G8 summit was in Toronto. And, of course, the cameras were there. CBC was there. CTV was there. Everybody was focused on Toronto as us Canadians. There was demonstrations on the street. And I think people were throwing some rocks. And maybe a window or two got broken. And somebody didn't pay for their Tim Hortons coffee. I don't know. But it was a national controversy. Meanwhile, in Winnipeg, without a lot of fanfare, religious leaders were coming together from around the world. And those religious leaders were discussing global policy. And so we were told that there is not really only one way to God. There are many ways, and we can know this God by so many names. And the world's religious leaders came together. It wasn't a large group, but we did talk a lot about enacting policy. Here's just a few of the organizations and religions represented. And yes, the size of the group wasn't very big. We're in the balcony as well. I was up in the balcony watching as an accredited observer. But we had the Sikh community and the Hindu Foundation Federation was there. We had two representatives from the Saudi Arabia Ministry of Islamic Affairs. They came in with their long robes. The Islamic community is very involved in interfaith work, very involved. World Council for Religions for Peace, Tony Blair Foundation. But by far, the religion that definitely dominated was us. We were there holding hands, kumbaya, for social justice and world peace. So this is some of the organizations representing Christianity. You recognize a few? If you want the documentation, again, Game of Gods breaks that down quite extensively. So what did we talk about? We're coexisting. We're coexisting to build world order. What we need is religious unity, coming together for common good and for world peace. If we can just do that, if we can coalesce around social justice themes. We talked a lot about providing global international governance and global financial governance. We need a world taxation system. We needed a new economic order. We talked a lot about having the United Nations itself becoming that structure, that framework. The Salvation Army, one of the Salvation Army representatives said this regarding financial governance. She said, it's not about having a bike for each. It's about learning to share one bike in community. Oh, that sounds so pleasant. I'm sorry. Eastern Europe tried that. It was a failure. Russia tried it. It was a failure. Venezuela's been trying it. It's an utter, utter failure. Yes. Yeah. No, this doesn't work. Sorry. A lot of talk of eco-justice, the gospel of respecting nature. One representative said that we are the biggest parasites on Earth. A lot of talk about the necessity of having Earth loyalties, that we need a type of new spiritually generated global Earth ethic. That was what should be the new framing story that we would be working with as we create a new order. And in all this, the United Nations has to empower world change, managing world change. So, same thing as the old, same story as the old story, right? Religion and politics do come together. So I'm going to take you real quick to two big events that demonstrate this on a larger scale. And that's the Parliament of the World Religions in its more modern context. Remember, 1893 was the first one. The second one took place again in Chicago 100 years later in 1993. 8,000 people attended, and there they worked on the creation of a new document called the Global Ethic, which is to be a new framing ethic for the world. In Cape Town, they gathered together in 1999. 9,000 people came. 7,000 people came. Then Barcelona in 2004. Then Melbourne. And finally, Salt Lake City. I attended that one. And then in Toronto last year. By the way, my friends Brian and Audrey are sitting over there. If you want to talk to them also about this event, Brian and Audrey came with me to the Parliament of World Religions in Toronto. And so I'm not the only eyewitness of this event. We have two others in the room who were there as well. So let's jump into this. I'm going to take you inside what the Parliament looks like, both 2015 and 2018, so you can get a grasp, you can get a handle of this. So at the 2015 Parliament, we had roughly 10,000 religious leaders and activists who attended from approximately 50 different spiritual paths. We had people like Karina Gore, Al Gore's daughter. She was one of our keynote speakers. In fact, she was made the ambassador of climate change and sent to the Paris talks fairly soon after the 2015 Parliament wrapped up. We had representatives from every kind of faith and background imaginable. Here's a few opening pictures of what the event looked like. This is literally the opening ceremonies. We have shamans and indigenous spiritual leaders and witch doctors coming in. They offered blessings on our event. They welcomed us all here. And it was a very much a carnival atmosphere. A few pictures from the event itself. Up in the top, we have a picture of religious leaders, Jains and Hindus and Sikhs and Muslims, and the circle of people was further out and extended with others as they're doing a world water ceremony, asking for the world water to be blessed, as we are all made of water. That's the idea behind it. Remember, 10,000 people were in attendance. The Sikhs came, and the Sikh community did the same thing in 2018. The Sikh community fed us all. They gave us a langar meal. And so they had thousands and thousands of meals that they distributed every day for free to all of us who were at the Parliament. That's a lot of work. That's a lot of food. And then we had, in the corner, we have whirling dervishes, Sufis. And they were doing their dervish dances. Has anybody ever seen whirling dervishes? Yes, I know Brian and Audrey have, and a few others here in the room have too. Anybody here then not know what it is? Most. Wow, okay. Sufism is the mystical side of Islam. All right, it's the mystical branch of Islam, and they do believe in a oneness. Very solidly believe in the oneness of all things. And what they are doing is they are engaging in a whirling dance. And so on the stage, if you can imagine, four or five people, there's a little band, they're playing their music, and then they're spinning, and spinning, and spinning. And not like an ice skater or a figure skater who is looking, you know, as they're spinning and kind of keeping their bearings. No. Their eyes are fixed, and they're spinning for 30 seconds, for a minute and a half, for 3 minutes, for 5 minutes, for 8 minutes. And they just go on and on and on. And it really is something to see. At the 2018 Parliament, we had a lady who was spinning, and she was going like, I mean, a rocket ship, just incredible. I was just awestruck at what she was doing. Because if I was to attempt doing this for 30 seconds, I know what happens. The ground comes up and hits me in the face, right? You probably have all done this. I mean, this is farm boy stupidity, but I'm from the farm, all right? Will you take a baseball bat? Who's done this? You stick your head against the baseball bat and you go round and around and around and around. You know what happens. It's a hoot. It was incredible. They just went on and on and on. So later on, I had the opportunity to talk to one of them, and I just asked, how? Well, it was explained that after a while, it doesn't take long, and you enter into a mystical state, and everything blurs and becomes one, and you feel the oneness. Interesting. A few other images. In the corner, we've got Tibetan Buddhists doing a sand mandala, literally a house of spiritual powers and principalities, demons and angels. In the top, we have a visionary artist demonstrating through artwork the oneness of all religions. Every day, every evening, we had angels walking up one side, entering, angels of light. And it would have been cool if I could have stepped back from that, because on the other side of the building were guys dressed in dark robes coming in. It was like, wow, only at the Parliament. And then in the far corner is a Hindu guru with his daughter and his daughter's young friend. They were about 10 years old, and he stopped us and he said, I want you to see something. So what he did was he took cotton balls and put them over his daughter's eyes, and then he put a mask over the eyes so they couldn't lift their eyelids. Then he wrapped their heads with scarves, two or three times. Now, it's not like they're on a stage. It's not like they're far away from me. I'm in their space. I mean, I can get down on my hands and knees and look up and see, can I see underneath, you know, their wrappings? Can they see through it? Is there earbuds? What's going on? You know, what kind of trickery? Well, there was no trickery. Then he gave us, the Father gave us little cards, and he said, write whatever you want to write down on your card. So I wrote down John 14, verse 6. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Okay? Well, it is. It is what it is, right? So the Father takes the cards, and he puts them in the girl's hands, and everything we wrote, didn't matter what we write, everything that we wrote down, the girls, absolutely blinded, could read word perfect. Yep, familiar spirit. Every single time. At one point, the Father takes one of the cards, flips it upside down, has it backwards, and the girl was stumped for a few minutes, and she just finally said, I can't read it, it must be upside down. We later on had a chance to talk to those girls, and they had told us that, look, after about a year of very intense yoga, we were able to open our spiritual third eye, awaken our kundalini, our chakra. At the parliament, we had a womb, literally the womb of the parliament. We had a red tent temple to celebrate what you women have that us men don't have, and that is a sacred red flow. Yes, it gets pretty interesting. And so during the course of the parliament, you could go and do lectures and hear lectures and workshops and see rituals as you celebrate your divine sacred flow. Up in the corner, it was a hallway of goddesses. And so we had approximately 90 or so depictions of the goddess. It's the Parliament of World Religions. So here's a few statements from the parliament. From Chief Paulette from Canada, from here. I believe he's from Alberta. He asks us this. He says, what is sin? The greatest and the biggest sin that man can make is to abuse Mother Earth. Brian McLaren, the father of the Emergent Church movement, gave us this statement as he opened up one of his talks at the climate change plenary at the parliament. I don't know which comes first. Do I love creation because I love the Creator? Or do I love God because I can't help but love the fish and the trees and the birds and the mountains and the fresh air? I don't know which comes first, but I know that the two go inextricably together. Brothers and sisters, the earth is singing to us. The earth is crying to us. The earth is groaning to us. No, it's not. The earth is groaning, but it is groaning for the redemption that comes by Jesus Christ. Not this. This is oneness. You are now in the camp of oneness, and there really was no distinction what he said compared to what anybody else said at the parliament. A few other quick quotes. This is from a workshop the first one is from a workshop asking the question, are we really all one? I am you, you are me. It is that level of unification and oneness that we want to address this morning because we thought it is the most fundamental level of unity, the most fundamental level of oneness, and it's not to be found just in reasoning or in dialogue, it's to be found in the direct experience of that reality within ourselves, to see the divinity in other people. That is a wonderful thing. These are just other statements that were made during the course of the event. What's interesting is the top statement, because it was given at a workshop asking the question, are we all one? The workshop began by demonstrating that reality. The moderator, and it was a room much bigger than this, asked everybody in the room to go into a brief meditative state, and then as you came out of that, to then throw out a word or a series of words that demonstrated your religious experience, your religious conversion, that aha moment in your religious life. Keep in mind, the room has Buddhists, Hindus, Wiccans, pagans, Christians, Jews, Muslims. We're all there. And so all across the room, people would shout out words like joy or redemption or happiness, just different words. And when it was all done, the moderator said, look, we're all speaking the same language. You all have different doctrines and different beliefs, but we're all speaking the same language. Really subtle. It's like that demonstrates that in our experience, we're all one. When you feel the experience, listen, church, listen, don't get caught up in the gospel of experience. And that's in the church in a big way. Don't get caught up in the gospel of experience. I don't discount experiences, but experiences never drive truth. Experiences do not drive truth. Don't confuse the two. And we confuse it all the stinking time. And that was demonstrated right at the parliament. I walked away going, all right, where does this feeling come from? How often do we take and say, God was moving in our midst, and we have confused a dopamine spike or some adrenaline or a neurochemical reaction, this feeling of what's called communitas, I'll talk about that this afternoon a little bit, with the Spirit. Quit. Let's think. Let's reason. Let's go back to God's Word. So I'll quickly take you, because we don't have a lot of time, to the 2018 Parliament in Toronto. And I want you to keep this in mind. This was our official theme, the promise of inclusion, the power of love. Boy, you could feel the love. And one of the statements, one of the opening statements, may the promise of the oneness of humanity guide this parliament, blah, blah, blah. So there is just a picture of some of the people gathering for our opening plenary on November the 1st. There's your theme, the promise of inclusion, the power of love, and it's a lot of people. It's a big event. Now, oftentimes we think of the Parliament of World Religions as a gathering of religious leaders. Yes, it is, but it's also a gathering of global political players. I recognize the fact that a lot of names here won't mean anything to many of you, but some of them might. Some of them might. Kim Campbell, former Prime Minister of Canada. How about our Federal Minister of Immigration? He was there. Doug Roche, he's a Canadian senator. There's quite a few others that were in attendance who were involved in politics in a major way. And I could have given you a list that was pages long of religious and political players, big-time political players. Lots of UN officials were there, a lot, because this is politics and religion. This is world order. Oh, before I go any further, if you want to come and check out what the Parliament is like, I've got the 2015 agenda book and the 2018 agenda book. They're big agendas. I mean, our agenda for this conference fits on the one side of a pamphlet, right? I mean, just pages and pages and pages of workshops. Check it out. So here's a few photos. This is the opening. Audrey and I, Brian didn't want to be in the rain, so Brian's somewhere up in the building. He I think he got pictures of us down here. And Audrey and I, we're underneath one of these people's umbrella. We're listening to lectures by Indigenous leaders about how important it is that we save and respect Mother Earth and how we're all coming back to the Mother and the oneness that we have with our Mother. The one far corner was a panel workshop with a Wiccan, Sikh, Muslim, Sikh, Christian, and they all represented various major interfaith organizations, all talking about how we coexist and come together. While I was at that workshop, Ryan and Audrey were at a workshop where they were discussing how to bring evangelicals into the interfaith community, because we're really the last holdouts, okay? Including some very specific action plans on how to do that. We were also discussing that to some extent at this panel. And then in the bottom corner was a workshop on the reemergence of classical paganism in Europe, including the reemergence of worship of Athena, of worship of Diana, a return to the ancient Greco-Roman religions, and how that it really is a thing already. Here's a real argument, and I make the argument in the book, look, we're not in a secular age. If we are, it's a secular type of spirituality. We are really in a new pagan era. And the argument, the line of reasoning I have is this in the book. Postmodernism has come to its end. Yes, we still live in a postmodern world. But postmodernism ultimately has stripped us of meaning and strips us of really anything that defines us. It left a vacuum, a void. Well, that void will be filled with something. It's not going to be filled with Christianity because we've rejected it. It's not even filled with materialism because that stripped us out and left us feeling hollow. So what will fill the gap? It is a return to the ancient ways. Here's a few other photos. Yes, we had a red tent temple for your sacred flow. There was a divine cosmic dance. That was a little table set up with different symbols from different world religions. I talked to the lady who set that up, and she was saying, hey, I'm showing you all religions through symbols. All religions ultimately say the same thing. No, they don't. Not even close. One thing that's interesting with the Parliament experience is that it gives legitimacy to new movements, to new religious movements. At the 1993 Parliament, the pagan community was legitimized when the 1993 Parliament brought Wiccan and pagan leaders to the table and said, you now are part of our multi-faith fold. At this one, ayahuasca was brought in as the new religious movement that we need to embrace and recognize as having legitimacy. Ayahuasca is a tea that you would drink, a tea that you infuse. It's also a religion. And what it is it's the combination of two plant substances out of the Amazonian jungle. If you are a tech entrepreneur in Silicon Valley, you will fly, maybe before you go to Burning Man, you'll fly down to the Amazonia jungle. You'll sit in a small communal setting. It's a group setting. You'll all sip the tea. You'll make sure that, first of all, you don't eat much for meat for the next few days before the event. And then you enter an altered state of consciousness. It opens up your perception, and entities will literally give you downloads of information. And when it's all said and done, you will likely puke for hours. And no, I'm serious. And you will fill your pants. It's not a pleasant landing. But it's a religious movement. It's a religious movement because there's new spiritual information being imparted. And there it received its legitimacy at the 2018 Parliament. A few other quick pictures. Yes, we had a labyrinth. If you have one in your church, please throw it away. That is a mystical tool of oneness completely. The top, we have energy healers, non-touch energy healers. And then here we had the same three girls. And we had a Hindu temple set up, like a big, beautiful Hindu temple with Ganesha and different representatives of other Hindu deities. And again, they were doing the demonstration that we can see with our spiritual eyes. And this year, they took it one step further. They would say, take out whatever you have in your pocket. And so I have lip balm in my pocket. And I didn't do this, but I watched as others did, especially the ladies, and they would give the girls, let's say, their lip balm. And then the girls would read the fine print on the lip balm. And you're like, okay. It reminded me a little bit of just the spiritual realities that come through in Scripture. You see Moses having his showdown with the Egyptian priests. Listen, this is a spiritual worldview. Don't kid yourself. There is a supernatural reality. And that does come through at the Parliament. Now remember, we're running out of time here quickly. Remember the theme, power of love and inclusion. That's so important. So important. It was such a loving event. There was no room for religious truth claims that were exclusive. We were told it was time to end separating faiths. Religious truth claims are taboo. The uniqueness of Jesus Christ, implied and overt, that is divisive. Nationalism, we were told over and over again, is the greatest threat. White nationalism is the greatest threat. Now the Liberal Party is playing that up. Where did you get that idea? Free market capitalism is evil and immoral. And we were told repeatedly that religious supremacy, national supremacy, and white supremacy, and it didn't even matter what your skin color was. It's not about that. It's not about that. It's about them placing upon everybody who doesn't agree with them an ideology of hatred that they can now pounce on you with. All of that equals populism, equals Nazism. That's what you are. Shame on you. Join them. That's the line of reasoning. And Jim Wallace, and of course, all the way through, the buzz phrase was supremacy, 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 ad nauseum. Jim Wallace of Sojourners, he was one of our keynote speakers for the opening ceremonies, talked about the midterm elections, because that's when the midterm was taking place, how it really was an election between angels and demons. And those who support Trump, well, you guess which side you're on. So here also demonstrates the power of love and inclusion. This is a Baptist minister using Tibetan Buddhist San Mandela artistry to create an image of the god Kali, Hindu god of destruction and death, holding the severed head of Justin Kavanaugh and the severed heads of all of those who confirmed him. The power of love and inclusion. And you wonder why, the evangelical community doesn't want to come on board. Huh? Really? You know something? I'm just going to say this real quick again. I've said it before, but I'm saying again, really talk to Brian and Audrey, because they are witnesses to this too. So we were told over and over again that what we were doing was offering a path of salvation. The Interfaith Agenda aligns with the power of the transforming power of the United Nations, particularly the Millennium Development Goals. We need to be guided by global governance. The Parliament brings a moral, ethical vision into global governance. We need to embrace our oneness. We need to celebrate our unity. And we need to engage in a global revolution and even be subversive to that end. One of the religious leaders said we need to embrace oneness or we will be forced to do so. The Catholic Archbishop, the Cardinal from Chicago, said what we have is one world with a common plan. And we had a Swami who put it this way: we, the peoples of the world, need to unite and demand a world government and a world parliament based on an earth constitution. And finally, Canadian Senator Doug Roche, said that we have to resist those who would be against us, and he meant you and me. And in all of this, it's salvation. It is a message of salvation. Larry Greenfield, as he closed his statements on the last day of the conference of the Parliament, said this: thanks to all of those who are committed to the salvation of the earth. Listen, the reason that this side, the interfaith side, which is a progressive left side, is so opposed to those on the right and those who are of a more conservative view, is that you are challenging their message of salvation. Because here on this side, we, I'm going to say we because I was there, I'm a witness, we are building heaven on earth, and shame on you for standing in the way. Keep this in mind. It's an alternative redemption plan. So more was going on than just that. We're going to wrap this up really quick. This is the top picture is from 2015. My friend Don Veneau and Don Veneau right down below with Brian and Audrey. There's my buddy Mark and Trevor. Don knows paganism really well. Trevor knows Mormonism really well and the Baha'i faith. Mark is an expert on the Moonies. Oh, and Bill Hansberger, right here, my buddy in the with a hat, talking to a Buddhist lady from Vancouver. Hey. This is an open door. So we go there, not just simply doing research, because we are, but we're also going there because every 10 feet you can talk to somebody of another faith. And you can engage them with provocative questions. And you can engage them with the gospel. And you can talk to them. And sometimes it's kind of tense, but sometimes it's pretty good. And we had some good conversations. And you don't know where it all goes. You're just there to plant the seeds, right? You're there to be ambassadors. I'm just going to skip ahead because we're at the end. Here is biblical problems, some problems of interfaithism that we need to consider as we watch our churches and our denominations just fold into this. First of all, the interfaith message undermines the truth claims of Jesus Christ. It doesn't undermine who he is. Never mistake that. It doesn't undermine who he is. The world can do whatever it wants. It doesn't change who he is. But it undermines the truth claim that we present as his ambassadors. In their view, all Jesus is another spiritual reformer, a good spiritual teacher. Hey, if all religions are equal, valid expressions of truth, then none of them are. And the atheists and the secularists can legitimately point to the religious community, all of us, and say, you're nuts. Because there has to be something that is true versus what is false. Otherwise, Christianity is just nothing more than another meaningless sect. Interfaithism undercuts the biblical Great Commission. We all work for peace and social justice, and we downplay and ignore biblical truths. And it entrenches the status quo. They don't challenge us. We don't challenge them. It's a big, happy kumbaya. It's a big, grand mush. And it sows a lot of confusion in the church. Let me tell you, does it ever? Absolutely. So the question we have before us, and we know the answer, is Jesus Christ the only way? Is he the answer? Is he the way, the truth, and the life? Yes. Don't allow this to scare you, please. This is just the way the world is moving. But allow it to open up your eyes to see the opportunity to be ambassadors for Christ in a changing world. Scott, our MC, I'll turn it back over to yourself. There you are. Thank you for coming this morning. You could have all slept in, but thank you.